From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
It wasn't enough that they spray painted him. It wasn't enough that they beat him. It wasn't enough that they dragged him. He had to zigzag across the road like that. They have to be a sick, cruel person to enjoy somebody's suffering.
A new documentary on the two towns of Jasper is about to be aired on the murder of James Byrd. We'll speak to the white and black filmmaker who spent a year in the two communities of Jasper, Texas. But first, the governor, George Ryan, clears Illinois' death row, commuting the sentences of all 167 condemned prisoners. A U.S. envoy travels to South Korea. Thousands rally in Lewiston, Maine, against a white supremacist group that wants the Somali community there out. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Dealing the sharpest blow to capital punishment since the U.S. Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional in 1972, the governor of Illinois has commuted the sentences of more than 160 death row prisoners. Governor George Ryan said, "How many more cases of wrongful convictions have to occur before we can all agree that the system in Illinois is broken?" Ryan, who leaves office today, stopped short of pardoning the prisoners but reduced their sentences to a maximum of life in prison. The blanket commutation follows an examination of the state's capital punishment system that determined 13 prisoners on death row were innocent. Ryan said he was a staunch supporter of the death penalty when he took office 4 years ago, but began to change his mind after watching a wrongfully convicted man walk free only 48 hours before he was scheduled to be executed. On Friday, Ryan also pardoned four men convicted of murder, saying confessions were tortured out of them by police in Chicago. In Washington, Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin called for a national review of the death penalty and a moratorium on executions. We turn now to Richard Dieter, executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center in Washington, D.C. Your response to the stunning development, the Illinois Republican governor clearing death row of Illinois.
Well, I think most of the public are going to see this as the beginning of the end. It's not that they are opposed to the death penalty, but they can see that it's just an unworkable system. It's a government program that cannot get it right. And therefore, the risks of executing the innocent and the unfairness of the death penalty are slowly going to lead to its demise.
Can you talk about exactly what the terms were that George Ryan laid out, cleared death row of 167 condemned prisoners? How many were pardoned?
Well, there were four pardoned on Friday in a separate speech. Those were cases in which the governor had determined the people were innocent and never should have been convicted. In the first place, they were victims of torture and coerced confessions. Those are part of the legacy that led to all of this, the mistakes that showed that the system was broken. And then on the next day, after a very careful review of all of these cases and hearing from victims' family members, from lawyers' petitions that had been written, the governor decided that the only fair thing to do would be to commute, that is, to take the death sentence off the table and reduce the sentences to life of the remaining people. So there's everyone on death row, other than those four who were freed, has now received a life sentence, and it's like 167 people. So it's quite an amazing saving of life in one day.
Richard Dieter, thank you for joining us, Executive Director of the Death Penalty Information Center in Washington, D.C. On Friday, the INS arrested at least 125 more immigrants from predominantly Muslim countries. The arrests all occurred when men voluntarily registered with the Immigration and Naturalization Service under a new immigration program. The arrests come in the wake of mass detentions last month in Southern California, where attorneys say over 1,000 men were detained. Over the weekend, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld authorized the deployment of 62,000 more troops to the Gulf region. And for the first time since the Gulf War, the Marine Corps has barred Marines from leaving the service. Meanwhile, a chief UN weapons inspector has told Time magazine that Iraq is, quote, far away from possessing nuclear weapons. And in London, Prime Minister Tony Blair is expected today to tell his Labour Party that Britain will not rush into a U.S.-led conflict without seeking renewed United Nations backing. And in related news, in Los Angeles, up to 15,000 people demonstrated on Saturday against war. Several more thousand marched in Minneapolis. The New York Times has determined that sexual abuse by Roman Catholic priests is even more common than was initially believed. At least 1,200 priests have been involved in abuse, which has taken place in almost every diocese in the country. More than 4,000 children have been victims of abuse by priests, and about 40% of priests were accused of molesting children aged 12 and younger. In the occupied territories, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinians on Sunday, including 2 teenage boys who were hit in a botched missile attack in Gaza City. An Israeli soldier and civilian were also killed on Sunday. Palestinians claimed that Israel was stepping up its attacks to distract voters from election-related scandals rocking the Prime Minister, General Ariel Sharon. And this news from Zimbabwe, the Associated Press is reporting that officials from Zimbabwe's governing and opposition parties are discussing a deal under which President Robert Mugabe would resign and hand authority to a new power-sharing government. But representatives from the governing party told the BBC they're not involved in any discussions. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia complained Sunday that courts have gone overboard in keeping God out of government. Scalia, speaking at a religious event organized by a former FBI agent, said the constitutional wall between church and state has been misinterpreted by the courts. In the Pacific Northwest, the Navy's coming under increased criticism, its use of depleted uranium and weapons tests. According to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the Navy is firing rounds of the radioactive material in prime fishing areas off the coast of Washington, raising concerns from scientists, fishermen, and activists. A coalition of environmental and anti-war activists are considering seeking an injunction to halt the tests. Meanwhile, the Pentagon plans to ask Congress next month for relief from environmental regulations that protect endangered species and critical habitats on millions of acres of military training ranges across the country. And finally, the Bush administration may approach the World Trade Organization with a case against the European Union for its ban on genetically modified food. U.S. officials are charging that the European position is, quote, immoral and leading to starvation in the developing world.
Do you want a society where the people are only one color? Do you want a society full of oppression and racism? Do you want the children to live in hunger in the streets? Do you want the people deprived of their liberty? Mba, 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 hey. Mba, 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 hey. I am so angry, so full of rage. I cannot express the fear I have inside.
Today we told 100 backwards days. Today we told.
You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In stark contrast to the U.S. threats of war against Iraq, the Bush administration is still attempting a diplomatic solution with North Korea. George Bush's envoy flew to Seoul yesterday in South Korea. James Kelly, an assistant secretary of state, is visiting Japan and China as well. The diplomatic crisis has severely escalated in recent days. On Friday, North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. That same day, Pyongyang warned the U.S. that a new Korean War would lead to World War III. And yesterday, the government newspaper said, if the United States evades its responsibility and challenges us, we'll turn the citadel of imperialists into a sea of fire. The U.S. press is widely reporting North Korea started the crisis this fall when it admitted it is pursuing a nuclear program in violation of a 1994 agreement. Bruce Cummings joins us, professor of history at the University of Chicago and author of Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History. Is that your view, Professor Cummings?
Well, my view is the North Koreans are conducting a sequel of the crisis that occurred 10 years ago. except on fast forward. In other words, in March of 1993, they announced their withdrawal from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, accused the United States of threatening them with nuclear weapons, issued a bunch of bellicose statements, and for the next 15 months, you had a kind of dilated, elongated crisis, very much like the one that's blown up in the last couple of months, in since October, really. This was eventually resolved in October 1994 by the Clinton administration agreeing to help North Korea with its energy needs by building light water reactors in return for the North Koreans freezing their nuclear reactor at Yongbyon. The Bush administration, since the inauguration of George W. Bush, backed away from that deal. Refused to negotiate with North Korea, raised a lot of demands against North Korea, such as reducing their conventional forces as a precondition for talks. So there have been continuous preconditions for talks, and now the North Koreans in the last couple of months have just decided to force the issue, and really what they're doing is trying to force the U.S. to come back to talks. Mr. Kelly in Seoul, after the Bush administration has said over and over again that there would be no quid pro quo. They would only talk to the North Koreans, but they wouldn't negotiate, and those talks wouldn't involve giving the North Koreans anything for their bad behavior, not responding to nuclear blackmail, so on and so forth. Mr. Kelly now says we'll help North Korea with its energy needs if they'll come back to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So, essentially, the Bush administration is managing to inch its way back to an agreement in 1994. That was a very fine agreement. It froze the reactor and put UN inspectors at Yongbyon for 8 years, and those were the inspectors that North Korea finally kicked out just a couple of weeks ago. But there's every indication the North Koreans would be willing to go back to that agreement if we would do what we pledged we would do in 1994, and that's not threaten them with attack.
The New York Times buried a photograph of a rally in North Korea in support of President Kim Jong-il of 1 million people and placed a rare pro-U.S. rally in South Korea of 30,000 on the front page. Would you say those pictures accurately represent what's going on in the north and south of Korea?
Well, the north can turn out 1 million people in its huge square in Pyongyang anytime it wants. It just gives them the day off from work. Gets the school children out of school and so on. Those rallies have been going on ever since this regime was founded back in the 1940s. What is going on in Seoul is utterly unprecedented. Not that 30,000 middle-aged and older people would support the United States, which is also something that involves giving people the day off from work and getting kids out of school. The South Koreans have done that for decades. Rather, every Saturday night for weeks on end, tens of thousands of younger people have been parading through the broad square near the American Embassy, Broad Boulevard there, with dignified, calm candlelight parades. Whole families are coming out. Middle-class folks are joining them in protest of a couple of American soldiers who negligently killed two Korean schoolgirls, but more than that, in protest of an American military presence that is going on 57 years now with a gigantic American military base right in the middle of this huge capital city. South Koreans want reconciliation with the North and have been pursuing it since Kim Dae-jung came to power in 1998. It took the Clinton administration about a year to realize that this was a serious matter, but it did then get behind South Korea. George Bush has been at odds with both Koreas since he came into office, has not supported the reconciliation, and now has a very difficult problem of not only managing a bellicose North Korea, but managing a relationship with a South Korea that is pretty much up in arms over Bush's policy.
The official statement North Korea issued when it pulled out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty said, after the appearance of the Bush administration, the United States listed North Korea as part of an axis of evil and singled it out as a target of preemptive nuclear attack, openly declaring a nuclear war.
Well, that's true. I never could understand why Bush chose to include North Korea in his axis of evil since September 11th happened out of the Middle East. Iraq and Iran are problems in the Middle East for American policy, but North Korea had absolutely nothing to do with Osama bin Laden. And in fact, on September 12th, within hours of the attack, they issued a completely unprecedented condolence to the United States on the loss of life at the trade centers. Furthermore, all of our major wars since 1941 were fought in East Asia, and September 11th gave us a bye, in effect, to try and get some reconciliation and peace going in East Asia. Our relations since then with China have improved dramatically, but Mr. Bush chose not only to include North Korea irrelevantly in the axis of evil, but then last September to table a completely new national security strategy, talking about preemptive wars, really preventive wars, against countries seeking to make weapons of mass destruction. And so to include North Korea in that is extremely dangerous because you have a war going on in North Korea, in the Korean Peninsula. The Korean War has never been solved. It's just an armistice. There's daily tension with millions of soldiers under arms along the DMZ. And so to include North Korea then conflates the longstanding conflict we've had with the North going back to the 1940s with this very new thing, al-Qaeda terrorism, attempting finally, of course, to disarm Saddam Hussein, which Bush's father failed to do.
Bruce Cummings, as you watch the news coverage of what's going on in Korea and also in Iraq, what is your sense of why, of how the Bush administration, the differential treatment with North Korea and Iraq?
Well, I think the Bush administration has just backpedaled and backflipped and drawn away from the very so-called principles that we were just talking about. In other words, if North Korea is part of an axis of evil and is making weapons of mass destruction, and we do have a preemptive doctrine, presumably we'd be going after them instead of having 150,000 troops assembling around Iraq, which is now the object of a kind of international proctology where inspectors are running all over the country and have been now for some time. So Kim Jong-il, I think, who may have a horrible domestic policy, but he's anything but stupid about foreign policy, decided to stick it in Mr. Bush's craw right now while the mobilization for Iraq is going on, rather than wait sort of for Mr. Bush, President Bush, serially to deal with first Iraq, then North Korea, and the third, presumably, Iran. So I think this kind of behavior on the part of North Korea is just something waiting to happen when you label somebody evil and stick them into your new preemptive war doctrine.
Bruce Cummings, I want to thank you for being with us, professor of history at the University of Chicago, author of Korea's Place in the Sun, A Modern History.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll find out why close to 5,000 people protested in Lewiston, Maine. Stay with us.
I'd like to reach far beyond the hate and touch the common bond between the races, a golden thread, every heart connecting, a brotherhood behind the different faces. We'll only know the true light of freedom. Every human soul has seen its beacon. Now we must go, following our reason. Love will lead the way to this new season. One world, who dares to dream? The greatest of the least of us to hold in high esteem. One world, can we conceive? That we weep, we become a family. One world, when will we see? How long will
One World by the Eclipse Band here on Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Some 4,500 people gathered in Lewiston, Maine Saturday to rally in support of the Somali community.
My name is Kara Gaumont.
My name is Sophia Noor.
And we're talking about our friendship today. During a summer program, we got to know each other, and I am so proud to say that Sophia is one of my closest friends. I've been to so many things, and I've experienced so many things because of Sophia. I've sat at her dinner table, and I've eaten food with her, and I've gone to a Somali wedding, and it's just, I would just like to say what an amazing door it's opened for me. I think that if we all learn to accept one another and to become friends with our Somali brothers and sisters, that we can achieve that beauty and that peace.
I am really surprised to see with so many schools around the world that some people are still ignorant. Who are they to tell me that Kara cannot be my friend because she's white and I'm black?
Sophia Noor, a Somali immigrant to Lewiston, and Kara Gaumont, both are Lewiston High School students, speaking at Bates College Auditorium. 3 miles away, the white supremacist group World Church of the Creator met and called for the expulsion of Somalis from Maine's second town of Lewiston. The controversy started in October when Lewiston Mayor Laurie Raymond wrote a letter to the local newspaper asking that no more Somalis move to Lewiston. He said Lewiston is unable to afford services for them. The city of Lewiston, Maine, has a population of 35,000. In the last 2 years, over 1,000 Somali refugees have settled there. World Church of the Creator leader Matt Hale used the perception of a besieged white majority that the mayor had put forth to promote Saturday's hate rally. The mayor was conspicuously absent from the weekend event on a golfing trip in Florida, though the senator and governor of Maine were there. Matthew Hale himself could not be at the rally. He was arrested in Chicago last week for allegedly soliciting the murder of a federal judge. We turn first to Stephen Wessler, director of the Center for the Prevention of Hate Violence at the University of Southern Maine. Can you describe what has been brewing in Lewiston?
Well, ever since the mayor's letter, there has been a tremendous level of concern with his letter and with the tension that exists between some small number of people in Lewiston and the Somali population. Sometime shortly after the mayor's letter, there was a march held in Lewiston where several hundred people walked to express their support for Somalis. And at that march, a different organized hate group, as old and as despicable as the World Church, a group called the National Alliance, showed up, actually created its own website about Lewiston supporting the expulsion of Somalis. Shortly after that, the World Church of the Creator announced that it was going to hold a rally on January 11th. And at that point, something really remarkable happened, which is a coalition in the truest sense of the word. I mean, hundreds of people from Lewiston came together to create an alternative event. And what you just described as having occurred on this past weekend was the end result of that.
And so the mayor wasn't there, but the governor and Senator Olympia Snow were?
The governor was there. Both our senators, both our members of representatives, the state attorney general, they were all there. And it was. And one of the interesting things is this really was a community rally. Neither of our U.S. senators and neither of our representatives in Congress were speakers. They just sat there through the whole event. The speakers were the governor, the state attorney general, but after that, other speaker on the show this morning, almost everybody else was from Lewiston, including those two remarkable students who you just aired.
We're also joined on the phone by Omar Jamal, Executive Director of the Somali Justice Advocacy Center in St. Paul, Minnesota, the largest Somali community in the United States. Omar Jamal is leading a national tour against hate, which has brought him to Somali communities in Seattle and Lewiston this weekend. Can you put what happened in Lewiston, what's been happening there, in a national context, Omar Jamal?
Thanks a lot. What happened in Lewiston is that the Somali community started moving in the city of Lewiston in Maine, and they've been initially received warmly by the community, but the mayor wrote a letter, and after the letter was written towards the Somali community asking them to discipline and advise other relatives not to come to Lewiston, there's been a tremendous increase of hate targeting the Somali community in the city of Lewiston, where we get phone calls from there. That's when our attention focused on the city of Lewiston, and the community started moving some of them back to Atlanta Church, where they originally moved to Lewiston. We talked to the mayor's office, and we asked the mayor to publicly apologize the letter, retract the letter, and have a conciliation meeting with the community to make them feel like they are a member of the larger community in the city of Lewiston. That did not happen. And we were there on Saturday when the community rally was taking place at Beth College, and we were equally shocked and surprised the absence of the leadership of the mayor of the city. And some of the community were really very upset. And what I find even more is that the people of Lewistonian, some of them, were not even talking about the mayor. There have been stickers circulating around saying, "Where is the mayor?" And based on that, some of the local community led a campaign gaining a momentum of calling the resignation of the mayor of Lewiston. Because let's not forget, this happened because the letter that the mayor wrote, and he's due to lack of leadership in this very difficult time in his city, that he wasn't there to show moral support to the community where there's a hate group calling the expulsion of the Somali community from the city of Lewiston. We found that very, very, very surprising.
And the Somalis who the federal government attempted to deport from Seattle, what has happened to them?
Well, it's been in the life of September 11th, our government created an environment where it created a criminalization of the group of community. Somalis was one of them. There's been a detention and deportation by the INS in spite of a federal, both local and federal judges putting an injunction, stopping from INS to deport Somalis back to a country where there's no any functioning government. We were again shocked to the flagrant disregard of the law of the land by the INS by detaining these people and at the same time deporting them. In Seattle, there were five of them in detention, and in Minneapolis, there are more than 40 of them in different cities. In Ohio, Columbus, there are another 40 of them. In Louisiana, there's another 20 of them. Now the INS cannot deport them because of the judge's order. They have to keep them indefinitely in detentions until they can fight legal fight against the judge's decision, so there was a hearing scheduled. So the community in general, after talking to them, felt that they've been targeted
seconds.
By the government.
Well, I want to thank you, Omar Jamal, speaking to us after being in Lewiston, Maine, this weekend, where 4,500 people rallied against a white supremacist group. And also, thanks very much to our guest from Lewiston, Maine, Stephen Wessler, director of the Center for the Prevention of Hate Violence at the University of Southern Maine. And as we move into this Martin Luther King birthday week, we turn to another community, and a few years ago also divided into two worlds along racial lines, to an interview I conducted last Friday. Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. It was June 7th, 1998, in Jasper, Texas. James Byrd was chained to a pickup truck and dragged to his death. James Byrd was black. The three men who murdered him were white. The town, Jasper, was forever altered, and the nation woke up to the horror of a modern-day lynching. There is a new film now called Two Towns of Jasper. In it, two film crews, one black and one white, set out to document the aftermath of the murder by following the subsequent trials of the local men charged with the crime. The result is an explicit and troubling portrait of race in America, one that asks how and why a crime like this could have occurred. We're going to begin where the film begins, and that is with a description of the crime. It begins with Sheriff Bill Rowles.
I was going to the Texas State Police Olympics in Dallas. It was on a Sunday morning, and I left my house about 7 o'clock in the morning when they called me. They just said they had a body by a cemetery in the road, and the first indication was it may have been a hit-and-run traffic accident. It appeared that a front end of this vehicle had got bumped and canted, and it appeared to be a tire mark, similar to a yaw mark coming in. And I followed that the entire crime scene, thinking that it was a tire mark. What I was thinking, this is going to be the easiest hit and run wreck that we'd ever worked, because we were going to be able to follow that trail all the way to the guy's house. We got to noticing that the track that was on the road was not a rubber tire track, that it was a brown, dark substance, but it wasn't tire tracks. And the further we went, the more my heart was beating, because things weren't as I was thinking they were. We found the tank top and T-shirt that he was wearing. We found both of his shoes. We found his dentures. And then we found the billfold. Then that's when I knew that it wasn't going to be a hit-and-run accident. I knew it was a black man that was dead. Hoping that it was a black man that had killed him. But it didn't turn out that way.
Rodney Coleman is the mortuary director.
Right away we knew, well, I felt, and I told my father at the time, I said, Daddy, some white people had did it. You just had that gut feeling that it was race related.
An excerpt of Two Towns of Jasper. And we're joined now by the filmmakers Whitney Dow and Marco Williams. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Well, can you tell us how you came to do this film, Marco?
A week or so after the murder, Whitney, who I've known for many years, called me up asking effectively two questions. What did I think about the murder, and what did I think about making a film about the crime? And in many ways, obviously, that's the seed that brought us to this point in time. Whitney was compelled to the story, and I think he should share why. I, though, said that while it was a terrible, terrible, terrible crime, it did not surprise me, nor did it shock me, because black men have been brutally murdered in America for centuries. But the idea for a movie was Whitney's initially. He wanted to make a film about this, and over time, the two of us melded our separate thoughts about the crime and our perspectives on race in America, and which ultimately yielded this strategy for telling this story.
Whitney Dow, why did you feel so compelled to do this documentary?
Again, it goes back to the crime. I think that I was compelled to go down to Jasper because, like many people, I was just so shocked and outraged when I saw the crime. It really, I think the reason why people responded to the crime so much is it reminded them something about this country that we like to think was past history, when in fact is just part of continuing history. So at that point, I watched the reports on the news, and then I heard that the Ku Klux Klan was going to be rallying in support of the white community. And it seemed like such a disconnect to me that I immediately wanted to go down to Jasper and learn more about the town.
So you both document this town, the two towns of Jasper. Can you describe what we're about to hear and see, which is the Bubba's in Training Club, Whitney?
Every morning at 7 a.m. in the Belgium Hotel in Jasper, a group of of middle-class whites who represent a wide swath of the town come and meet and have breakfast every day. And every morning they would just sit around and talk about the events of the day. And that because the trial was going on across the street, many times the trial was the subject of those discussions.
And the salon that you filmed at, Marcos? The hair salon?
Yes, Univis Salon is... perhaps the equivalent of a barbershop on the male side of the black community, but in many ways very different because the concerns in this space are women's concerns. Obviously, it's predominated by women, and I think they give a kind of a glimpse or insight into the broader spectrum of the town in terms of its racial makeup and the concerns of the black community.
Now, many communities may have Bubba in training clubs, but they don't usually hang out a shingle like this one does. Let's go into that breakfast.
I think that it's wrong what they've done. I think it's very wrong what they've done, and I don't think there's any question that they've done it. But still, I want the defense to come out and tell who James Byrd was and what he was. Because James Byrd wasn't the pillar of the community that they made him out to be.
I think you ought to be judged by the way you live, not the way you die.
The whole community knows.
They're portraying him that like he was a good Christian person.
And they're naming city parks after him and giving his family all kinds of awards and
money.
Money.
You don't think he ought to be a martyr?
No, I don't. I don't think he ought to be put up as a role model for our children.
Too late.
And then there's the black hair salon.
Everybody says it's an isolated incident. It is not. It has been going on for quite a while. It's never been to the magnitude of what it is now.
It never will be the same again.
But
yeah. It's more. You always will look over your shoulders wondering. It happened once. Nothing happened.
When Mr. Byrd was brutally murdered, you know, blacks didn't rage. We didn't burn things. We didn't go out and do eye for an eye. Well, some of these children have never had to face anything like what they're facing now. You know, it's helped us kind of prioritize some things around here, like why there's only one black person working at the bank, and why there's a bank who has a whole lot of black customers and ain't no black working there. You know, it's just bringing things to light. Since we're on the battlefield, we're talking about all the little wars we have to do.
Excerpts of the two towns of Jasper here on Democracy Now!, and we're joined by the two filmmakers who documented the community after James Byrd was murdered, right through the trials of the three men who were charged and convicted. Whitney Dow and Marco Williams are our guests. Marco, you said that this crime didn't surprise you, given the history of race in America and the crimes committed against African Americans and black people. Did anything surprise you when you went down to Jasper and spent your time, you documenting the black community and Whitney documenting the white community, from your experience?
The one thing that surprised me initially was what I commonly refer to as the muted rage within the black community. I could not understand why the black community was so not up in arms, particularly in a community that was 45% African American, in which the mayor is black, in which two of five city council members are black, in which there are a number of blacks in leadership positions. I would have thought that there would have been a much greater outrage and outpouring of emotions. But it's a scene like the beauty salon where I began to have an understanding of why the rage was muted. If it happened once, it could happen again. I heard that refrain quite often, that this wasn't the first time that a black man had been dragged or brutally murdered in that community, in that region. As one of the men I spoke with said, the only difference between the others and this is that Byrd got televised. So I was caught off guard by that, and then I appreciated why in this town, in spite of the racial makeup, it was really business as usual, i.e., whites were in power and blacks were subordinate, and they were afraid for their jobs and they were afraid for their lives, as a refrain I heard as well. That did catch me off guard, and then I appreciated what it must be like to live there. And in many ways, it made me realize that's what it's like to live anywhere in America if you're black.
I want to go to the district attorney, Guy James Gray, who talks about who the men who were on trial were.
These guys had been in the penitentiary. They're out of touch with the real world. They're back in a mindset that goes back to the 1920s and 1930s. And when they came out, they had in their head that the law here was like it was 50 years ago, that there was not going to be a vigorous search for the killer of a black man. Bill King was absorbed with these terrorists. Type organization that exists throughout our country. You get a general idea of what he has on his body, where you have his gang affiliation, Confederate Knights of America, his Nazi affiliation with the Lightning Bolts, Aryan Pride. One here is a little tattoo of a hanging black man that's blown up next to a Klansman in a robe holding his hat and a burning cross. Did the same thing on Brewer. But you got that triangular clan affiliation, Confederate Knights of America. There's his patch, clan, burning cross, Confederate flag.
The Jasper District Attorney talking about the tattoos of one of the killers of James Byrd, Bill King. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll return to the two towns of Jasper in a minute.
Today we took 100 backward steps. Today we chose greed over integrity. Today we chose hate over equality. Today we took 100 backward steps. Today we took 100 backward steps. 59% of us chose to turn teachers into spies. 59% of us chose to refuse pregnant mothers' care. 59% of us chose to reserve health care for the wealthy. Mba, 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 hey. Mba, 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 hey. I am so angry, so full of rage. I cannot express the fear I have inside. I am so angry, so full of rage.
You're listening to Democracy Now! As we talk to the filmmakers of The Two Towns of Jasper to air on January 20th on POV, PBS, Marco Williams and Whitney Dow. I asked Marco to talk about spending time with the Byrd family.
James Byrd had a large family, and it's a family filled with a great deal of emotion. Obviously, a family steeped in faith, religious faith, which I think really held them together. And I was told in some ways held the town together, that their decision not to call for an eye for an eye initially, their decision not to call out for burn this town down, sort of set the tone overall. And yet, as you've seen in this excerpt, by the third trial, the emotions, the rage, the pain was now out completely.
This was Sean Berry's trial.
This is Sean Berry's trial, which is the third trial of the three.
How long did the three overall?
The trials began
King
in
first.
Bill King occurred in January, February 1999, Russell Lawrence Brewer in August, September 1999. And Sean Berry in November 1999. So you can see about 10, 11 months of trials, and that's a year and a half or so after the murder of their family member.
You talk about how the family felt when the death penalty was handed down against two of the three murderers. On the one hand, you had a response that finally justice is done, but then you also had members of the Byrd family, like Ross Byrd, James Byrd's son, who ultimately went to Huntsville to stand in a vigil outside the what some call the death penalty capital of the world, where men are held as they are executed, to speak out against the death penalty, even in the case of his father's murderers.
Well, I think Ross Byrd gives insight into the fact that people do change and grow. Because when I filmed Ross Byrd during the course of the trials, he wanted to see these men sentenced to death. So that says a lot for him and his growth, personal growth, his own choices, his religious faith, the things that impacted him. But during the time of the trials, he wanted to see all three men get the death penalty.
You document changes in people. Changes like one of the main people, Whitney, that you followed, was a man who himself was an Aryan white supremacist. Can you talk about him?
Yeah, Trent Smith was a really interesting character when I met him, a really fascinating person, because here was a guy, he was exactly like the people who committed the crime in a lot of ways. He had just gotten out of prison for a long stretch. He was covered head to toe with tattoos. He was a member of the Aryan Circle and was really very spoke out very forthrightly on his views about the separation of the races. And he represented for me what the townspeople really considered the problem. They viewed the three defendants as a lightning bolt that came in and struck their town, but that they weren't really connected to the town in some way, even though two of them had been raised there, even though one of them ran the local movie theater. They viewed it as a force outside of themselves. And here's this guy who they have identified as the problem, who's one of the few people that I met in town who could actually really look at himself and examine his views in the context of the situation, the trials that he watched unfolding, in the context of his own life, and ultimately make some changes in his view of the world.
Well, let's go to him as he talks about his tattoos.
I got a lot of tattoos in prison.
Every tattoo I have has to do with my heritage, some kind of way, Irish and Norse and the Vikings.
I was in the Aryan Circle, and I still am.
This is the Celtic crosses. Typically what the skinheads use to identify who they are. Along the side of my arms is white power. It's what I believe in. White power says everything white pride says, as well as f*** you. A lot of white people are still with a guilt complex that they owe somebody something. And the black people can play that. Not all black people, not all white people, but that does happen a lot. And I would be willing to bet my job and all the money that I could possibly make next year, that I could go into that cemetery where this prayer vigil is going on, and I could look at these people, and I can identify them and know who they are, and I can meet them at a club, I can meet them at a cafe, or at a diner, or at church, and talk about black people, you know what I mean? And then I find out that they're raised exactly like me. That they don't really want to be around them, that they're okay, they're afraid of them, they have a guilt thing about them. They feel like they may owe them something. They don't like that feeling, so they would rather be away from them. But when this thing kicks off, they run out there and they join this prayer vigil and they're holding hands and saying we're getting along, and it's really not true. It's all fake.
Trent Smith, 1 year later.
I've changed my views partially in one way and completely in another. Hey, I don't want to have anything to do with the Aryan Circle or the Aryan Brotherhood or the gangs. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Okay, the second thing is though, my views about mingling with people of other races. I don't believe in intermarriage. Other than that, I don't have a problem. Eating dinner, going to the ballpark, hanging out. Actually, I tried to give a guy a job a while back who happened to be Puerto Rican. He was a black Puerto Rican. He's got a real good conversation.
I'm
going to try to give him a job if I can.
Bottom line is you got to treat people, all people, the way you want to be treated. You know what I mean? And then that's what I do now. I used to not do that. But then again, I grew up in prison, too, where that don't happen. So it only took a year, though, to really realize the difference.
Trent Smith in the new POV film that will be airing on PBS. Going through, well, let me ask you, Marco Williams, would you call it a transformation?
Trent Smith? Yeah, I think that I buy it. But you have to see the film. I mean, I buy it because, A, it's over the course of a period of time. The young man got out of prison after being in prison for 12 years. If you watch the film, he begins thin, strapping, muscular. He meets a woman who has three kids. He marries her. She fattens him up. He's going to have another child. So there are the physical manifestations of change in his life completely. So why couldn't there be the emotional, intellectual, philosophical changes? And as Whitney and I often joked in the editing room, Trent went from being a separatist to a supremacist to a separatist to perhaps a capitalist, a true American. But in fact, yes, yeah, so I buy it. I think that why shouldn't there be change? We talked about Ross Byrd. He changed. That's an important thing. I think that's really, in some level, what the movie strives to understand or address. What are the differences? How far apart might we be? How do we bridge them in order to affect or arrive at change?
There's another part of the film where you deal with Martin Luther King holiday and the, well, what would you call it, the cancellation of the holiday in Jasper, Texas. Whitney Dow, what happened?
There's been some construction in the local high school, and they were trying to, so they had lost some days coming back from the summer of when they could open the school, so they were trying to find days to take back from the holidays in order to extend the school year to meet the federal requirements and the state requirements. So they identified some days, and one of those days was the Martin Luther King Day that they were going to take away. And
this is after
this is
James
during
Byrd.
The middle of the trials. So understandably, the black community responded very, very strongly to that happening.
What was it like in the black community then?
What was it like in the black community? Well, I think there was a fair amount of rage.
So what did they demand?
They demanded that they better put it back, plain and simple. But that demand was arrived at, and I think one of the things that the material shows in the film is that there were some members of the black community, some ministers, who basically went hat in hand asking, you know, could we have this? Could we have that? And then one very strong member of the black community, a minister, demanded, and he told the supervisor of the school board that they had to put that back or else. Now, the or else might have been a boycott of various things. It was overturned, and as Ray Lewis sort of concludes, he appreciates that perhaps this occurred because they thought they could get away with it, that nobody in the black community would say anything. And perhaps in the past, prior to these trials, that may have happened. During the course of these trials, that wasn't going to happen.
The question of, is there any change? We're in the week of Martin Luther King's birthday now, in 2003. And if you'll forgive me, I'm looking at a piece in the New York Post. And it was on Friday, January 10th. A blackface attorney plays Diallo card. And the piece says, the lawyer for a cop fired for appearing in blackface in a racist parade float grilled former police commissioner Howard Safer over his handling of the tragic Amadou Diallo shooting, suggesting NYPD brass applied a double standard in their treatment of the two incidents. Chris Dunn, a civil liberties lawyer, needled Safer by saying that the tasteless float was more serious in your mind than four police officers who fired 41 shots and killed an innocent black man while on duty. But the former top cop hit back at the lawyer, saying, the fact is the Diallo shooting was a series of tragic mistakes. This, the float, was dedicated intentional racism. Joseph Licurdo, who is suing the city over his dismissal, was fired within weeks of appearing in 1998 on a Labor Day parade float that attempted to make a joke out of a black man's lynching in Texas. Yes, it's about James Byrd and how this fired police officer, along with two firefighters, Jonathan Walters and Robert Steiner, were part of a float where they dressed up in blackface, threw watermelon to the crowd, were carrying containers of fried chicken, and Robert Steiner dragged himself behind the float. The firefighters, Steiner and Walters, are also suing to be reinstated. I want to get each of your thoughts on this.
Well, it's funny because that particular float has a long history of being used to make what some would say, you know, sort of unpleasant political statements. The one before, I understood, was called Hasidic Park 2000, I think, and they had it all dressed up as Hasidics.
This was called Black to the Future.
And this was called Black to the Future. So they always were sort of looking for something. You know, it was interesting to see that It was funny that when that happened during the course, it was actually, I think, during the course of the trials when it happened. And
it
of
was
course,
here in New York that was.
Yes, and in Jasper, they all pointed that and say, look, you say you have problems. We have problems here, but, you know, there's problems everywhere. I feel a little uncomfortable talking, because I'm not, it was interesting, you know, some of the other guests you had on earlier who are lawyers can speak to the actual legal ramifications of it. I mean, it's, for me, it was shocking to see that somebody doesn't have any understanding of the impact of their actions. But it comes back to a lot of the things that I learned in making this film, in the fact that most people, and you see it in the film, are very, very, very comfortable with their view of race, especially white people, because they view it as such an individual process. They view their relationship with black people individually and are very comfortable with that. So when I took the film back to Jasper this summer and showed it to everybody, to a person, really, really liked the film, because for me that was a compliment, meant that I portrayed them accurately. Now I'm predicting that when it comes out and there's a public reaction, there's then going to have a very different response to the film.
Well, as we come to the end of this interview, you are not only showing Two Towns of Jasper, but this is a major series of events. It will be showing on POV around the country on PBS, POV being standing for Point of View, the series on PBS. Also, Ted Koppel is going to be holding a town meeting in Jasper to respond to Two Towns of Jasper. What do you hope to come out of this, Marco?
Well, I think as a filmmaker, it's always my hope that the work that I do inspires or engenders questions, so i.e., it provokes or promotes action. I'm hopeful that at the very least that this will have a wake-up call quality, that the national broadcasting of our film, preceded by a Nightline program and followed up by a town hall that will be a discussion of race in America, will get people talking at the very least, get people considering their own viewpoints, trying to understand the viewpoints of a community that they perhaps don't understand or are not part of. We have to start somewhere, and I'll be very candid with you. I'm not enthusiastic that the divide that separates black and white, or the many divisions that separate us, whether it's across gender, nationality, ethnicity, sexual orientation, I'm not sure that they're easily bridgeable, if bridgeable at all. But if we're going to find or be able to create the foundations to build those bridges, to support what is necessary, we have to acknowledge our own bias, we have to understand it, and we have to be able to look across that divide and say, you think like that? Let me at least hear you. Where are you coming from? How come you feel like that? Let us at least stand as equals in order to bridge and remain equal.
On that note, we're going to wrap up this discussion. I want to thank you both for being with us. Marco Williams, Whitney Dow, the filmmakers who have done the film Two Towns of Jasper. Thank you. And that program, Two Towns of Jasper, will air on January 22nd, POV, on PBS around the country. And that does it for the program. Tune in to CNN today at 12:30. I'll be on Wolf Blitzer's show talking about Iraq and North Korea. You can get a copy of today's program, Democracy Now!, at 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is www.democracynow.org. democracynow.org. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. Tomorrow, Sarah Jones. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.